Hello everyone, my name is Phil Blancato. I am CEO and President of Latimer Thalmann Asset Management, a division of Advisor Group. Today is already June 17th. My gosh, how time flies. Very soon we'll get to the shortest day of the year, one of my favorite days of the year. One reason specifically is I'm an eternal optimist, and that is the longest day of the year, the most light. So hopefully you're outside enjoying the longest day of the year, enjoying the sunshine. The heat's killing the virus, from what we can tell in most places, and certainly like every other droplet that can be harmful to you, it dries up in the sunshine, and being outside, you are 10 times less susceptible to the virus of catching the virus than you are when you are inside. So a quick factoid for you. Today we're going to go over the latest updates to the virus, the economy, and how we are positioning portfolios to give you an idea of what you should be thinking about as you continue to manage your assets with your financial advisor. Well, jumping right in, as by means of update, we always try to first start off with what's the latest on the virus. And looking at places like New York City, where the daily rate of infections are now consistently below 100, in fact, most days below 50. Adding to that, thank God, the daily death rate continues to be very low. And some days we've had actually zero deaths, and some days, most days less than 50, and some days less than 20. So New York City has improved profoundly. When you look at the folks who have passed away in New York City, and I think it behooves us just to start there, because it's an idea of setting the framework for as we open up as a country, what should our expectations could be, and what should it do to the overall economic impact. Of the 17,454 folks that have passed away, far and away, roughly 98% of the people have passed away, nearly 99, had an underlying condition. Adding to that basically, when you look at the total math of those who have passed away, it was far and away people above the age of 65. So a significant number of people that have passed away from the virus were older in New York City. And when you sit back and you think about that, how does it really come to play? Well, we looked at some of the statistics around the world. And as of right now, 80% of Americans who have died from COVID-19 are older than 65. The average median age of the folks who have passed away, believe it or not, is 80. So it tells you how skewed this is to older folks and how we have to work very hard to protect them. Individuals under the age of 65 accounted for just 4.8% of total deaths. Just to give you an idea of where this emphasis is, when you look globally, basically the statistics are almost exactly the same. In fact, in late March, Americans over the age of 75 made up half of all weekly deaths, while those under 45 made up less than 4%. Those over 85 made up the rest. However, when you think about the folks who pass away from this, I think it's a bit of a misnomer that if you're over the age of 65 or 75, even 85, you're automatically likely to pass away. That's actually not true. Of the folks who get the disease that are over the age of 65, only 6% of them are hospitalized. So that's really important to know that if you're healthy and you're in good shape, whether you're 65, 75, 85, or even 90, there are many success stories about people getting better. In most cases, the virus is relatively mild. So I think it's helpful to know that. When you think about the deaths in the United States, we're closing on nearly 60% of all deaths being from folks in a nursing home. It really is pretty profound when you think about how, as we go forward, and as we open up the economy even further, what is it we need to do to make sure people are going to be protected? Obviously, it's first and foremost those with existing underlying conditions. And then more importantly, it's going to be about when we look to see how we open up safely, it's protecting the elderly, especially in nursing homes or long-term care facilities. Now, I'm going to get into the second wave. I know that's a hot topic, and I do want to touch on it a bit. But before we go to that, I thought just some interesting stats to think about. U.S. confirmed cases continue to be about 20,000 a day. Yet in the United States, we've increased the testing from, believe it or not, less than 50,000 a day when we first started this to nearly 1 million a day. In most states, we're doing 500 to 750,000 tests per day in the United States. There are multiple states where they're increasing the testing by anywhere from 50% to hundreds of percent more. So right now, the United States seems stubbornly stuck at around 20,000 cases a day. We've had dipped down. We have dipped higher. But that's in large part due to the increased number of testing. What we're watching is the infection rate, which is so critical, continues to hover right around 6%. We're not seeing the infection rate in the United States go up significantly higher, which is a great sign. That means what we're doing is we're finding out who has had the virus, who has the antibodies, but we're not seeing a lot of new, very sick people, especially going to hospitals. Now, I know there's a few states that are seeing an increase, but the reality is that increase is actually a bit overblown. And I'll get into that in just a minute. The one thing we continue to see on a very regular basis is that the number of people who are dying, not only in the United States, but around the world, is coming down precipitously. And in fact, when you look at the United States, when our average number of deaths were just about 8,000 a day, and now we've come down to less than 1,000 a day, the pattern is very observable that we are down significantly and the number of people are passing away. And that's not just a U.S. phenomenon. When you look around the globe, we're seeing the total fatalities come down by two-thirds of where we were when this originally began. So that's exciting that you're seeing around anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 people a day pass away globally when it was much as 8 or 9,000. Now, we had some bad days here and there. There was 6,000 that passed away yesterday globally, but the day before that was just a few, just over 1,000. So by and large, you're seeing the global fatality rate come down quite significantly. And then we look at the averages, a seven-day moving average. Western Europe at this point looks really very strong. Western Europe has done an excellent job of taking their daily new cases and basically flatlining it down to almost zero, other than the UK. Still has a bit of a high number. We have had numerous days of what we call negative growth rates, meaning the number of people getting better is significantly higher than the number of people who are getting sick. So our total number has come down. In fact, if you looked at our average case rate over the last 7 days, every single day was lower than 7 days ago except for one. So we are going into consistent negative terrain. That's a wonderful sign in spite of the fact that we're increasing the amount of testing. And that's not just here, but that's also around the globe. Where we hope, we are projecting that we will be consistently negative. We had actually hoped it would be this week, and truth be told, it would have been by today, by the 16th, yesterday. And we are consistently negative, as I mentioned, 6 out of the last 7 days, but not quite there consistently enough. So that bears watching to see how much further we can be consistent in going negative. So that is really pretty good news around the virus, except there's this narrative around the states that are reopening and what it's doing from an overall second wave. Well, let's jump into that for a minute. When I look at a state like Texas, and it is true that Texas's number of daily new counts are going higher, but what you'll see in Texas is their death rate continues to go lower. And in fact, not only does their death rate continue to go lower, they have roughly 1,675 available ICU beds, meaning they've got lots of capacity if people tend to get more sick. Remember, they had never had nearly the number of cases we had in New York City or in other heavily hit states like New Jersey, so they've always had a very low count. But Texas has tested 1.5 million people. In fact, their daily fatality rate was higher in May than it is in June by a consistent amount. So that same narrative is playing out here. Not only do they have a lot of capacity, they are testing more, which looks like the number of cases are going higher. But in reality, at the end of it all, the number of people who are being hospitalized is only up marginally, a few hundred people. And then add to that, the death rate is coming down because we know better how to treat people. Some of the new drugs on the market are helping that specifically. Switching over to Arizona. Arizona is another state that's been in the news quite a bit. Well, their daily death rate peaked on April 30th. They had 26 deaths that day. Yesterday, they had 9. So as you can imagine, there is a significant drawdown in the number of folks who are fatally passing away. Now, it is true that their ICU beds have gone from 38% of capacity in the state back in April down to 20%. But believe it or not, for a state of roughly 7 million people, that increase represents in physical people only of about 300 people. So in other words, back in April, they had about 1,000 ICU beds in use. Today, they have about 1,300, and they still have room to go. My point is, sometimes we get caught up in the percentages, but the reality is, in sheer numbers, it's still not a lot of people. Now, there is a little bit of pressure on our hospital system now, but we're watching their death rate is actually coming down, and we're seeing people recover fairly quickly. And that's because, again, of the improvement of how we're treating patients. So in that regard, while it is a concern that there's a number of states who have seen a mild tick up, For example, Oregon slowed down their opening. But I sometimes wonder what the motivation is here when Oregon's worst day ever was simply 200 new cases, back to their normalized rate of 50 cases. So they did have a spike. They went from 50 people to 200 new cases. However, they're also increasing testing. And in fact, their hospitalization rate went down, not up recently. So it seems kind of odd to me that just because of new cases, they would open up when the reality is we care a lot more about hospitalizations. And even Florida, a state that's constantly in the news, did have a high number of new people being tested. But when you look at Florida, we hit 2,800 cases on June 28th. However, when you look back in time, their death rate was 41 people passed away on May 17th and on June 2nd. And yesterday, it was only 5. So as you can, the same scenario continues to play out, that as testing goes higher, number of people finding out have the virus goes higher, but in reality, it's not having an impact clearly on hospitalizations, a minor uptick if at all, and at that, we're seeing the death rate go down, not up, which is a very positive sign. And then one other point. Remember Memorial Day weekend, we had the beginnings of protests. We had lots of people celebrating out in different parts of the country. And there was grave concerns in places like L.A. and New York, the Carolinas, lots of hotspots. And the reality is it just hasn't borne any fruit. And looking at Minnesota, an area where obviously there were lots of protests that are weeks old and continuing, when we look at the data from Minnesota, there were 1,313 deaths as of June 16th. Daily new cases has been decreasing since the peak of 974 on May 21st. On June 1st, there were 578 cases, and it's come down since then. The daily death rate has been decreasing as well, 35 on May 28th, down to 9 most recently. Hospitalizations are also down, from 600 down to 300. And the testing has increased by roughly 10,000 a day. So you can imagine, with the protests that took place and folks really weren't concerned about social distancing, it really had no impact on the virus spiking higher. And for that reason, we remain optimistic that we are very much in control of the virus. Remember, we've talked about two things we need to know to be able to open up our economy. The spread of the virus and who's affected by it, now we certainly know that. And then secondarily, how to control it. What can we do to make it better? Well, the controlling aspect is a little bit of a different narrative. First off, the average age of the American workforce of people under the age of 54, which represents 76% of our workforce. We know those folks are very, very, very minorly affected by this disease. As again, people under 65 only represent 4% of the total death rate. And of that 4%, most had a pre-existing condition. In New York City, anybody under that age other than one person died of a pre-existing condition. So we know who is affected by this, and that allows them to go back to work. But in fact, people under the age of 64 represent 93% of our total workforce. So that gives us the opportunity to let folks go back to work because we know how much they're going to be affected by it. Go one further. There's been so much concern around how, in fact, we get the disease. And if you haven't get a chance, this weekend there was a wonderful article in the Wall Street Journal called Consensus Emerge on How COVID-19 Spreads. I'll read it one more time. Consensus Emerge on How COVID-19 Spreads. And the article goes on to say the real way we get this isn't from touching a surface and touching your face. It really is only a small part of that. This is very much so an airborne disease. And the only way to really get it is if you're within 6 feet of somebody, not wearing a mask. That person is probably coughing, talking loudly, or breathing heavily, aerosolizing their droplets in their mouth, and you need to be with them for an extended period of time, more than likely 15 minutes. And at that, you need to inhale enough of the virus to catch the virus. So what we're finding is that there's a lot of false narratives out there about how you might get it. You know, getting a package from Amazon is not how you get it. Running, biking, walking with friends and family that you know are not sick is not how you get it. It is spending time with someone who you don't know or you're not sure if they have it for an extended period of time without proper protection, specifically a mask or a face mask, that causes the disease to spread. So that's really very important because now we understand how not to get it. And that should bear out as we go over time. It does make sense to continue social distancing, but it does allow us to open up our businesses and really allow them to engage in a way that'll make for an opportunity for businesses to grow. And that's important because as the economy has been shuttered for so long, we really need to be careful about how long we continue to shutter before we allow for economic growth again. And we're beginning to see some of that. But we understand there's a balance between how much we need to open and being safe at the same time. Look at the economic impact from this standpoint. There's three phases to it. There's the initial contraction phase, and that's when everything kind of went to heck in a handbasket real quick. Then from the contraction phase and the economy shutting down and the market selling off, we get into the transition phase, the beginnings of reopening. A real surge in economic data. You saw, we talked about this last week, the unemployment number proved to be a very exciting number. That we saw a real spike in unemployment, meaning the number not being nearly as bad as we expected it to be. We thought we were going to see 25 to 30 million people unemployed. In fact, the number reversed, where today we have 21 million people unemployed. Still a terrible number, but not as bad as we thought, and that's because of the beginnings of the reopening. So that initial spike is the transition phase. And then finally, as we get out of our transition, we move to a recovery phase, where we're going to see kind of fits and starts with data. Some months we'll see better data, some months we won't. Because as of right now, the Federal Reserve and the Congressional Budget Office is still predicting we're going to have a negative 6.5 contraction year over year on our economy. We'll still have double-digit unemployment through the end of the year and won't get back to 5% unemployment until the end of 2022. And at that, 2022's growth rate will probably only be between 3 to 5%. So this is not a golden lever, pull it, and the economy is going to just go roaring back. But it is a slow expansion over time, which should allow us to begin to open up, get people back to work, and begin to shield shield off from further economic damage. We're not alone in this. When you look at places like overseas, for example, Great Britain had a 22% decline in the month of April. That's their worst month in over 300 years. It shrank their economy back to the same size as it was in 2002. So Europe and Great Britain in very difficult straits, just like Japan and some of the other developed worlds. So what you're seeing is many of the countries are really putting efforts forward to reduce the impact of this. You know, the United States has put out just about $11 trillion, or intends to. We've spent about $3 trillion so far, to mitigate the recession. And truth be told, it's worked. The PPP program, or the Protection Program for Small Businesses, has been very effective in keeping people ready to get back to work. That's why we saw the number of work change last week. They've actually lessened the severity of the program. So instead of having 2 years to pay back your note, you're going to have up to 5 years to pay back your note. You can use the money more for operating expenses and not just employee expenses. So that was a nice welcome change. You know, the Federal Reserve has backed up the corporate bond market by saying as companies need to borrow money, they can come to us, and even municipalities. And then just a few days ago, Secretary Mnuchin came out and said the White House is seriously considering another round of stimulus payments to make sure we build that bridge to the other side of this. Places like Germany are doing the exact same thing, where the Chancellor Merkel just signed off on a 57-point stimulus package for the country of Germany for citizens and businesses, and China is embarking on the same approach, as is Japan. Why? Because money is cheap right now. You're able to finance debts at a very low cost. Now, you don't want to do that forever, because then what happens is your economy may never grow out of it. Europe is very much in that space. They have so much debt, it's very unlikely they'll ever really be able to grow out of it. We don't want to put ourselves in that situation, but we need to spend enough to get the engine started again. Think of it as a primer on an old car. Remember, we used to have to spray a little bit of a ignition agent into the carburetor to get an old car to run sometimes, or one that hasn't run in a while. A little ether. Well, it's kind of like that. We use a lot of money to spray a little ether on the U.S. economy to kickstart it, and it's working. So far, initial data is telling us that we are beginning to open up, and in fact, when we go through some of the data of late, it really is pretty exciting that we're seeing some of the numbers that tell us that things are slowly but surely getting better. And that's important, because it isn't just about solving the virus. We need to make sure we protect people and keep them safe. But economically, we need to make sure that we're turning back on in a way that we do both. And that came out in something just the other day when we saw retail sales, the amount of money people spend month over month. Surprisingly, the number came out to be the largest single month increase in 1 month in U.S. history. Really very exciting. We saw a 70% increase in month-over-month retail sales. And in fact, when we look over year-over-year, we're only down 6% in retail sales from a year ago. The consumer, you see, those who were gainfully working still from home, didn't spend any money. They had a 30% savings rate. So that means for every dollar they make,
they saved 30 cents. And as the economy began to open up, they decided to spend some of that money. So that really showed through in that data. Now, we did have bad data as well. The first quarter earnings wrapped up, and companies lost 8% in how much they earned in the first quarter. We're expected to lose 40% in the second quarter. It's very unusual to see the stock market close to, not quite yet, but close to all back to all-time highs, and we have the economy contracting. The stock market's predicting that there's a lot of good things to come, that there is isn't going to be a second wave, that there is a vaccine well on its way, that we won't have a messy election, and in the aftermath of the election, we won't have terrible tax policy. That's a lot of big promises for the market to be expecting all that, and that's why you've seen the market run so far so fast. As you know, we've talked in the past, probably a little too far too fast. We still think the market could correct in here and actually get to where stocks are fairly valued, because right now they're expensive. They're expensive because companies are earning less, and yet they're back to near all-time highs. That's not the best recipe for success. We did see some good data come out of the housing market. We saw mortgage applications for the 9th consecutive week grow to very high volumes. So people are taking advantage of low interest rates to refinance. You refinance at lower rates, you have more money. We're watching corporations refinance at a rate we've never seen before, issue new corporate debt at very low interest payments to be able to shore up their balance sheet, maybe have more cash on hand if things don't go well. We see new home optimism. Builders have the largest increase in home builder confidence ever. Now, they're not yet building a lot of homes. They're still only building less than 1 million a year. We actually need to build around 1.5 million. Building new homes is a catalyst for the economy. So disappointingly, we're not building them yet. But that is a good sign that the beginnings of, or at least the thought around it, is there. And I do think it's important to note that, you know, housing can be a real stimulant to the economy. It's an area of the economy that can be very positive because there's people who get paid to build it, lumber and other materials go into making it, and banks get to lend for it. So that's a very positive when we see the economy grow at that kind of a rate, something to think about as we go through this. When we talk about that retail sales number, I think it's fun to just for a minute talk about where we saw the big jump. We saw everything from gasoline, healthcare, clothing, all jump up significantly. Furniture also jumped up. Electronic appliances. And when it comes right down to it, there really is this notion that whether it's in France where there's a run on jacuzzis, whether it's in California or Louisiana seeing pool installations up 200 to 300%, or it's boat sales that are skyrocketing and boats are flying off the shelves at a rate we've not seen in a long time. So kind of amazing that for the consumer that sees a pretty gloomy economy, came out and decided to spend at a pretty rapid pace here. So overall, the stock market has come back. Wow, has it come back a lot? It has really come back a whole heck of a lot. But at the same token, I think it's exciting that when we think about that the consumer's ready to spend as their optimism increases. And you might remember last week we talked a little bit about consumer optimism and how it was up pretty significantly. So I think that's a good sign that optimism translated into consumer spending. And spending is what drives our economy, especially when the consumer has a lot of cash. Remember, we're not in debt as a country right now. When you put it all together, it's exciting to note that, you know, we've come a long way on the S&P 500. It's back to where we're just about down on the year, only about 3%, and from the peak at about 8%. It's come really far, really fast, and it's because of those expectations of a virus and an easy election and turning back on won't get slowed down. But I think for that reason, we still should continue to be somewhat careful as we look at how much we're invested in equities and what equities we're owning. It's better to own bigger companies with stronger balance sheets, stronger companies that can withstand more volatility in the marketplace, rather than smaller companies or international companies that have a lot more to worry about. And that's what we've done in the portfolios. We're still holding a little bit of cash to make sure that if in case something goes wrong, there's an opportunity to do that. You might want to think about holding a little bit of cash or being a little safer right now. You know, the idea of you're participating in the marketplace, but you're also protecting your assets by holding high quality bonds, high quality stocks, and a little bit of cash. Let's switch gears to the virus, because it's always fun to wrap up the call with a little bit on the virus front. And there's a lot going on. The federal government is now partnered with 5 different firms: Moderna, Oxford University and AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Pfizer. Separately, and their partnership means they're going to fund them with money and work with them closely to monitor and produce vaccines, as well as go through phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials. It's Operation Warp Speed, and so far we're seeing real fruit from it. Separately in China, there's 2 firms that have come up with a vaccine. One of them is Sinopharm. They gave two doses 28 days apart and, believe it or not, had 100% effectiveness of creating antibodies. Now, we prefer it's an American vaccine first because that means we get to turn our economy on faster and protect our people sooner. But it's as a means to an end, if China does have a vaccine, then certainly at some point we would benefit from it. A separate company, another firm called Sinovac, they're the folks that cure the swine flu, have a vaccine with 90% efficiency, and they're in phase two trials as well. So they're moving quite rapidly. But we're right there behind them. In a partnership with Oxford University, there's a new existing drug called dexamethasone. It's a steroid. And why this is important is a steroid that's easily accessible. Believe it or not, it only costs about £35 to cure or save a life. In other words, the number of doses you would need, it's basically $40 to help somebody get better. What it does is help bring down inflammation in the lungs. And we found that the UK figured this out, that for people on ventilators, it brought down the death rate from 40% to 28%, and patients on oxygen from 25 to 20. That's really exciting that we have another tool to help us, the most terribly sick people. And remember, we talked a little bit about Gilead scientists, a drug called remdesivir. Now, remdesivir helps fight off the virus. So in other words, in taking your time of being sick from 10 days down to 5. So now you've got a cocktail approach. You can use the steroid from the UK, doxycycline, if I get that right, coupled with remdesivir. One will fight the antibodies. The other one will bring down the inflammation, helping the most sick people get better. Coming back to where we began. If we can keep pressure off hospitals, then in fact, we'll be able to reduce the pressure on hospitals and open up that much faster, preventing people from dying. Remdesivir is actually partnered with a number of companies now to be able to produce enough of their vaccine or their drug for 127 different countries now. So really getting their drug around the globe, and especially here in the United States. So exciting movement there. Now, moving right along, that's an existing drug that we can use, and we're excited about the progress there, but there's also lots of movement on creating new drugs. Moderna is a name that we've been talking to you a lot about, is actually well on their way into phase two, and soon will be entering phase three trials, with the idea that they could have 1 billion doses of their vaccine ready by Thanksgiving, and the early results have been excellent. So they continue to make progress as they go into phase three. Moderna is one we have great optimism on. Johnson & Johnson, a major U.S. drug manufacturer, has come to market, and they are beginning their vaccine testing in late June, early July. While we think that's powerful, it's not only they're partnering with the federal government, they did have an Ebola vaccine, so they're using the same process they came up with that, but they can also manufacture millions of vials in a short amount of time, and they've already lined up over 1,000 people to take to try out and be part of the study. So that's very important that they're moving along that quickly. So that's on the vaccine front. I always like to talk about therapeutics, meaning something you can take to get better. And the big news there is Regeneron. Regeneron is a company that we've talked about in the past as well. They have a 2-antibody cocktail that they believe in a matter of 48 hours can get you significantly better and fight off the virus by helping your body create more antibodies. So in other words, it's teaching the body to create antibodies to fight off the virus. They are well on their way in the phase two trials. They're actively testing folks. This one I'm very excited about because this will come to market before a vaccine. And if there really is a second wave, this would help prevent that wave significantly. And it's another American-based company, so our folks would get to it first. And they started phase two, and we should have results here in early July as to how it's going. Add to that, Eli Lilly has an existing arthritis drug, which they think will help take inflammation away from folks' lungs. Another type like the steroid to reduce inflammation. That's in phase three trials as well. And they have a multi-antibody cocktail that they think will help get people better as well. So those are good news on that front as to another drug that's become the market in short order that acts as a pill that you would take to get better, but not cure you, but certainly get you long along the way of improvement. And then finally, Distributed Bio, they have an antibody as well. They were one we've talked about early on as well. They have now come out with a new data set where 97% of testing has been effective. So so far in gerbils, not in humans yet. They're moving to human trial in the next few weeks. But of the 97% of gerbils that they tested, of the gerbils they tested, 97% showed the effectiveness to reduce the virus within 48 hours. So another one that you could take and be a lot better in a short amount of time. So that's a lot on the virus front, why I'm optimistic about it, and as is the market, because it's now that we know how you get it, and there's a number of these therapeutics coming out, some of them existing drugs, it does make for us to be able to turn things on more quickly. There are some weird things going on, like there, for example, you know, the glass that you put a vaccine in is actually becoming very hard to find. Johnson & Johnson, to their credit, before they ever decided to jump into this market, ordered 250 million vials from Corning, and Corning has now been backed by the federal government to create millions of vials for everywhere else needs them, but kind of unusual that we're running out of and a very particular type of glass for the vaccine front. A little unusual, but those are the weird things that happen when you're running at full steam to try and get ahead of a disease that could, you know, hurt people and hurt the economy. One other way, for those of you who know New York City, the Magnolia Bakery, right over here in Times Square, that sells famous cupcakes. They're now developing, they have a system where you'll walk through what looks like an x-ray machine. You'll get flashed with an ultraviolet light for 20 seconds. That light will kill any virus on your body. Now, if it's in your body, it doesn't help you, but it will kill anything on your person. They're doing the same thing for the New York City subway system and considering launching products like that using ultraviolet light in numerous locations where the flashing of light for about 20 seconds will kill the virus. It's amazing the inventions that are coming to bear. For those of you who've ever gotten your nails done, you know, you go to the salon, use ultraviolet light to harden the paint. It's basically the same thing. That same kind of approach in a big flashing light will kill the virus. That's a new way to attack it. That is a whole new approach. So when it comes to killing the virus, it doesn't just have to be medical. It's a combination of know who's most affected by it, know who can go back to work, know the basics like wearing a mask. A mask does help prevent you from giving it to someone or getting it. A face mask even more so. Gloves aren't necessarily as important because it's very rare to get it from a surface, especially as every droplet, every water in general dries in hot sun and humidity. So as we warm up around the country, that's going to reduce the spread outside. But what we now know is you have to have extended contact with someone who has the virus to get it. So you sum it all together, there are rays of sunshine or green shoots in the economy, retail sales being one of them. There's still a ways to go. You're still looking at earnings being terrible. Our second quarter GDP will be the worst in our lifetime. Unemployment is still over 20 million people. So let's not think that things are perfect yet. They're far from it. It's going to take a long time to get back there. But the worst seems to be over. The only thing that can prevent make it worse would be us going back into a second wave. And to be quite honest with you, as I delve through the data, it's just not significant enough. It's a bit more about headlines now than it is reality. Nowhere is anywhere close to what happened in New York City or even New Jersey. Think of it this way. Texas, with their spike, is still 88% lower than New York ever was. So it's not even close to that. And New York was far and away, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, were far and away the most deaths. Most of them in nursing home, most of them in the greater New York City area. But that's just not the case in other parts of the country. It's great to be diligent, but so far that's not a concern that would slow us down from reopening because we know who's affected. We know who we need to protect. We know there's things we can do to make ourselves better, drugs we can take, and then methods like wearing a mask that'll lessen the impact overall. It does bear watching, though. We have to continue to watch the data to make sure that there isn't a legitimate spike and there isn't a concern of shutting down again. And for all those reasons, we'll continue to do these calls. Hopefully, they give you some insight as to where we're going economically, that there's the beginnings of some sunshine here, and certainly we like where the market's at, but a little bit concerned. There is progress on the medical front from companies like Regeneron or Johnson & Johnson. And then there's understanding of the processes we need to go through to be able to manage this disease for the foreseeable future. With that, I hope you're healthy and you're safe and you're sound. Hopefully you're going to go outside and enjoy some sunshine if there is some by you and get outdoors where you're much less likely to get this thing. And stay safe, stay happy, wash your hands, don't touch your face, wear a mask, and I'm sure we'll all be better sooner rather than later. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day and speak to you next week. Bye-bye.